The following is a repeat broadcast of the Global Research News Hour, which originally aired April 22, 2016. Is the contemporary climate movement truly forcing the hand of governments to change their behavior in a fundamental way, or is it serving a more insidious agenda? What evidence is there that elite players like the Rockefellers, Bill Gates, and the Clintons are manipulating 350.org and other prominent environmental organizations? How does the fossil fuel divestment movement actually enhance the economic systems destroying the planet? What evidence is there that environmental NGOs have undermined indigenous and racially marginalized peoples around the world? Are there indications that environmental leaders themselves are distorting the science around climate change? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the occasion of Earth Day, we have a frank and candid conversation about the current ecological crisis and the inconvenient truths about prominent environmental organizations, false climate solutions, and the dire situation facing humanity. Our guest for the whole hour is investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist Corey Morningstar. On this week's program, the non-profit industrial complex and the co-opting of the environmental movement, a conversation with Corey Morningstar. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of the April 22nd, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Washington may have one last joker up its sleeve, reintroducing the gold standard, the very gold standard that Nixon abandoned in 1971. A new U.S. dollar gold standard would most likely be set at a ratio that would wipe out all U.S. debt, including future unmet obligations, as measured by the GAO, or General Accounting Office, of about $125 trillion U.S. To counter the buildup of this criminal last-ditch sham by the Western Zionist banking czars, China and Russia have been preparing over the last few years an independent financial system delinked from the U.S. dollar and which now incorporates the BRICS, the SCO nations, as well as the Eurasian Economic Union. This association of countries and economies account for about half the world's population and at least one-third of the globe's economic output, a fact totally ignored by the mainstream media for obvious reasons. The Machiavellian sinking ship does not want its passengers to jump to safety. That comes from the article, "The Collapse of the Western Fiat Monetary System May Have Begun, China, Russia, and the Reemergence of Gold-Backed Currencies," by Peter Koenig. Posted April 21st. DHBE released both the Moscow 2011 video of the bomb attack at 9:07 a.m. instead of the Brussels airport CCTV footage, as well as the still image allegedly from the same CCTV airport source in the departure terminal of the three terrorists at 10:25 a.m. If DHBE had been in possession of the real surveillance video footage at 9:07 a.m., why on earth would they have released the Moscow airport footage and then 1.5 hours later come up with an allegedly authentic image from the CCTV airport cameras? While police and surveillance authorities would be able to view and analyze almost immediately the camera footage of the bomb explosion, the same does not apply to the process of identifying three passengers with trolleys mingling amongst several hundred airline passengers also with trolleys in the departure terminal. In other words, to identify three individuals from a large number of airport CCTV cameras with hundreds of passengers traveling early morning would not have been an easy fast-track undertaking. The still images pertaining to hundreds of passengers would have had to be examined, compared to police photographic records, etc. An almost impossible task to achieve in a matter of 2 hours after the blast, assuming that Dernière Heure had access to the CCTV surveillance video data. That comes from the article, The Brussels Terror Attacks, Fake Videos and Images, The Man in the Hat, by Professor Michel Chossidovsky, posted April 20th. Possible future strategic uses of a PLAN carrier battle group include deployment in the South China Sea to effectively increase Chinese area control access denial capabilities. Potential regional adversaries such as Taiwan, Vietnam, and the Philippines would have to alter their strategic calculus to account for the added threat of a Chinese carrier battle group in the region when considering any future warfare scenarios. The armed forces of Taiwan have taken notice of the threat and conducted war games recently that involved the addition of a PLAN CBG in a hypothetical invasion of the island nation. It is most likely that the first three aircraft carriers are just a developmental stepping stone to a much more flexible, capable, and powerful class of aircraft carrier. If it is one thing that the PLAN has shown in recent decades, it is committed and capable of developing and fielding modern, complex warships and weapon systems in its quest to stand on a level playing field with any potential adversary, chief amongst them the United States. That comes from the article, Video, China's New Aircraft Carrier Force Challenges U.S. Naval Hegemony, by Southfront, posted April 20th. President Barack Obama has said the classified pages of the 9/11 Commission report that do not compromise major national security interests may hopefully be soon released, but argued against any potential legal action against Saudi citizens. Obama, who flew to Saudi Arabia on Tuesday, discussed in an interview with Charlie Rose his relationship with the Saudi regime and the controversially classified 28 pages of the report, which some believe contained links between 9/11 terrorists or Al-Qaeda and Saudi officials. When asked by Rose if he had read the pages, Obama said he, quote, had a sense of what's in there, unquote. Rose also asked about legislation that would allow relatives of 9/11 victims to sue the Saudis, which passed the Senate Judiciary Committee in January, but has yet to be voted on by the full body. Obama has said that he doesn't support the bill due to the possibility of foreign citizens, presumably victims of U.S. wars and drone strikes, suing the government. That comes from the article, Obama, if we let Americans sue Saudis for 9/11, foreigners will begin suing U.S. nonstop. Posted April 20th, originally appearing on RT. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Friday, April 22nd, when this episode first goes to air, marks Earth Day. It's a time when ecologically conscious community members attempt to reflect on their impacts on the natural world and make efforts to reduce those impacts. Listeners to this program may remember conversations with guest Dr. Guy McPherson, who describes the climate crisis as a predicament and not a problem. Problems have solutions, predicaments don't. But it is the nature of modern humans to expect solutions. If we just roll up our sleeves and apply the right amount of resources, particularly financial resources, to address the situation. Worse, those of us living in privilege in major Western centers are seeking out easy solutions and expect to find them. This makes us vulnerable to the messaging of non-governmental environmental organizations, all too eager to assuage our consciences while keeping us all in our physical comfort zones. That is, we can save the world and make money doing it. Enter the environmental non-governmental organizations. Prominent players like the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, and most prominently these days 350.org have been the major powers behind a burgeoning climate movement, which we are told is forcing the hands of economic and political power brokers as we shift political and economic priorities toward taking the necessary steps freeing us from the destructive fossil fuel economy. Our featured guest today has a lot to say on the topic of climate change and the inconvenient truths lurking behind the shadows of these NGOs. In fact, she's written extensively on what she calls the non-profit industrial complex, and for all the talk of system change is actually enabling a system that will only exacerbate the ecological crisis. Her name is Corey Morningstar. Corey Morningstar is an independent investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist focusing on global ecological collapse and political analysis of the non-profit industrial complex. She resides in London, Ontario, Canada. She has contributed articles to Counterpunch, as well as Wrong Kind of Green, TheArtOfAnnihilation.com, and others. She's been making frequent appearances on the Nature Bat's Last radio program on the Progressive Radio Network and is now making her debut on the Global Research NewsHour. So, welcome, Corey Morningstar.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Okay, I thought I would start the program because you're such a... I find your writing very... I respect the clarity and the provocative nature of your writing, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to just open our conversation with a quote from your repertoire. So if you might want to...
Sure. And I just wanted to say your intro was amazing.
Thank you.
It was really good. Okay, I'm going to open up the show with an excerpt from part two of the expose, The 2 Degree Death Dance, the 1% cover... The 2 Degree Death Dance, the 1 Degree Cover-Up, which was written back in 2010, I believe. And I think it's good paragraph to open up, considering Earth Day is tomorrow. Okay, so here goes. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Okay. The art of propaganda has been nothing less than brilliant. The deceit is so thick, you need a knife to cut through it. The corruption and greed so deep, you need wings to stay above it and thigh-high boots to wade through it. An alluring tapestry of luminous lies, interwoven with finely textured deception and silk-like corruption, as smooth and seductive as freshly churned butter. The pursuit of man's mind by way of domination has been the greatest and most successful experiment. The manipulation of man's mind has resulted in a massive erosion of empathy, which has allowed status quo, business as usual, to continue uninterrupted with little resistance. Capitalism effectively bred a contempt for our Earth that multiplied like a virus. The pollution of mind mutated into narcissism with inflicted self-hatred to form a suicidal Molotov cocktail. Those who have succumbed now hold hands in a circle and taunt the very planet that gives us life. The ugly side of humanity continues to violently pierce our Earth Mother with drills and slash her beautiful skin with razors. She is losing breath. She is dying. Yet when she lashes back, it will be with an Armageddon death blow against which our own actions will resemble childish prattle. And perhaps not until this time will global society finally recognize that our shared purpose was not to compete with one another and claim dominance and superiority over Earth Mother, but rather our role was to protect, defend, and nurture. The human family, under the arm of its Euro-American Big Brother, will have finally succeeded in conquering our shared planet, only to find that we have destroyed ourselves.
Well, thank you for reading that for us. And you're definitely talking about. You start off talking about these levels of deceit, propaganda, and there's a sense of us being misled. And at the same time, we do hear people. I'm talking about regular people who look at the messaging around the climate change and ecological collapse, and many of them wishing to do what they can, but I feel that there's an earnestness there, but it seems like there's not only the deceit coming from these external players, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but also a level of denial that we want to continue living our lives in a certain fashion, and we want to have these sorts of easy solutions. As our mutual friend would say, nature does bat last. Could you speak to that point about, like, first of all, just that how being our own enemies, that we, for all of, what we may look at intellectually, that we're not really willing to do the things that need to be done.
Yeah, like even that's such a big question. The simplest things, the whole quote unquote green movement has become all about consumption, green consumption. And when we look at solutions, it's not about how do we radically alter our Western lifestyle and our, wild consumption habits, and how do we separate what we need from what we want? How do we separate those two things? How do we live with as little, taking as little as we possibly can take? It's all about consuming more, under this guise of green, sustainable consumption. And it's, a very convenient lie to continue living the way we are, to continue exploiting our brothers and sisters across the planet, that all these, that this lifestyle completely in the system completely depends on exploiting and at an accelerated pace. And we do know these things, these aren't this exploitation of our brothers and sisters and our planet is nothing new, but we conveniently, pretend, I sort of call it an agreed upon alibi. We pretend we can do these things in a kind, gentle manner to continue, this lifestyle, which now has resulted in lifestyle wars, resource wars, for what's left. And there's no talk, coming out of NGOs, which are all part and parcel of the nonprofit industrial complex, coming from government on, how do we contract this economy? How do we do with less? Like how all you hear is, we want more, we want more. Now we want windmills, we want solar, we want electric cars, we want, we want, we want. And the more we produce, the more we destroy, the more we exploit. There's no way around it. Mm. So I think there's a lot of convenient denialism happening.
One of the leaders of the climate movement is the celebrated journalist, author, and activist Naomi Klein, who is also a board member of 350.org. Here's a clip from a recent talk held in Winnipeg before an audience of over 1,000 people.
I think Kevin Anderson puts it very well. He was deputy director of the Tyndall Center. He says we have to differentiate between going more slowly down the wrong road and getting on the right road. They are not the same thing. And I think that's part of the hype around green tech is that green tech can maybe make us go a little more slowly down the wrong road, but it is not going to help us veer. In order to veer, and that's what we really need to do, we need policy, and we aren't going to get that policy unless we organize. So we can't leave this to our elites, you mentioned that, I mean, there is a awareness, right? I mean, I have a chapter in the book called The Billionaires Won't Save Us, about how you can have a figure like Michael Bloomberg who knows a whole lot about climate change, gives great speeches about it, funds a lot of green groups through his foundation, publishes reports about how climate change is a huge risk to the U.S. economy, but yet, with his $33 billion worth of wealth, he invested in a specially created fund, a fund that specializes in oil and gas, because we have a structural problem that, at the same time as you can understand the medium to long-term climate risks, you're still going to be drawn to the short-term rewards of investing in the problem. And we've got lots of examples of that.
I asked Corey Morningstar to comment on the apparent contradictions between Ms. Klein's recent messaging about altering a predatory capitalist system and the way environmental NGOs appear to reinforce and protect a plutocratic status quo.
You know, it says right in the jacket of the book that the really inconvenient truth is that it's not about carbon, it's about capitalism. And the convenient truth is that we can seize the existential crisis to transform our failed system and build something radically better. So there's, capitalism is the problem, but we got a solution.
Well, that's the funny thing. That whole book, that whole project, the book and film project, was funded by the same foundation registered that 350 operates under, what's it called now, the Sustainable Markets Foundation. And the website, even 350.org, is registered to, I believe it's Jay Halton of that Sustainable Markets Foundation, which funded the Book and Film Project, which is also funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, Ford Foundation, goes on and on. So what you're getting is not radical movements, coming together, environmentalism, anything like this, with true environmentalists. You're getting exactly what's been packaged and designed by foundations who have everything packaged and waiting in the wings for us. I mean, these NGOs are extensions of the state, they're extension of the oligarchy, and they're not real movements. Mm. You know, and if you go to 350.org, that organization began as Step It Up. We're going way back now. I'm not sure. I don't have my notes or my articles in front of me. But I think back to around 2007, and then it morphed into One Sky, which was an incubator project, which a lot of these NGOs are an incubator project of the Rockefeller Foundation. And then it was funded and taken under the wings of the Clinton Foundation. And then in 2011, 350.org was operating under another banner, and that became the one that really, became a powerful force of connecting with people. So they went with that one, and then they merged the two together. And then since then, it's a multi-million dollar force, funded by... I mean, not all the funders are even disclosed. Some people, they won't even disclose, but it's... it's a huge way to manipulate the populace.
Yeah.
Without being directly involved. I mean, it looks like separate entities. The oligarchs over here, the foundations over here, right? All funneling money from the corporations into the foundation, into the NGOs. But it's all in the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In this huge... these trillions of dollars that are funded into the nonprofit industrial complex, it creates a very, very successful form of self-censorship. I mean, you don't even have to be told what to say and not say, right? It's automatically understood. If you don't toe the line, you're kissing, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of funding away.
Mm. I see that you, in one of your previous articles for Counterpunch, you quoted in a February 2013 article you wrote, and you quoted from a Financial Post article which talked about the Rockefellers' involvement, and said in that article it said that since 2007 the Rockefellers have paid $4 million U.S. towards OneSky and 350.org tax returns, say. And the Schumann Center provided $1.5 million U.S. to McGibbon's three campaigns, as well as $2.7 million U.S. to fund the environmental journalism program at Middlebury College in Vermont, where McGibbon is on staff, and that their list of 350.org's list of donors fails to convey is that some foundations provide only $5,000 to $10,000 or $10,000 U.S., while two unidentified donors provide half of 350.org's budget for 2011, according to financial statements. Now, if we're talking about these, like Rockefellers, like the 1% of the 1% of the 1%, it seems hard to believe that they're interested in dismantling this capitalist economic order in any significant way. So what is their game here?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, this is all about power, and this is about keeping the system intact for those who it serves, which are the most, obviously the rich and the powerful. And so the nonprofit industrial complex is set up as this wall to sort of protect this power structure. It insulates it, it protects it, and even more than that, it allows it to expand. And so going back to what you were speaking about a few minutes ago, Klein's book, what's called Capitalism versus Climate or whatever, that book project and film project, well, that is, the irony is she doesn't actually, if you go to, here's a fellow from Australia, an activist named Michael Swift, does really great research and a bit of writing and following these NGOs. And he says, she never says we have to dismantle capitalism. It's not about dismantling capitalism. That's what she says. And the point is basically the whole divestment campaign. Right now, according to, and it's been going this way for a couple years and even longer, you can see all these articles at the McKinsey Institute, blah, 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 about, the global economy has become stagnant. There's nowhere else to grow. Under this capitalist system, we have to keep expanding. We have to keep growing. Well, we've hit, as Larry Summers says from Goldman Sachs last October, we're flying close to stall speed. The World Bank has said the greatest threat to the world, basically, is stagnant growth. We have to keep growing. If we don't grow, we collapse under this system. And so here we have one of the few opportunities in recent history where our system, the capitalist system, is actually teetering on the brink of collapse. So if we're really serious that it's climate or capitalism, this is the time to dismantle, right? To start dismantling and thinking, how are we going to replace this system into a living, reasonable living arrangement. But instead, we are told we're going to divest and invest, and all this does is protect the system from collapse. We're trying to inject trillions of dollars into a dying system. We're trying to create new markets out of the financialization of all nature on the planet, payments for ecosystem services. So they're desperate, to save their power, to save the system that's, basically slowly collapsing.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Could we just maybe drill down a little bit on that topic of divestment? Our radio station here is located on a university campus where there's a major push for divestment of our university foundation's assets away from fossil fuel industries, and that's a major plank of the whole 350.org and their affiliate organizations. And on the surface, it seems like a responsible thing to do. Like you reflect on South Africa and how boycotting South African companies was help bring down racist apartheid, maybe not economic apartheid, but certainly racist apartheid. You think about the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement against Israel, which seems to be making some kinds of progress. So it's easy to understand how people who are earnest students and activists and academics could get caught up in that campaign. These fossil fuel companies are just exploiting the oil wealth and contributing to the destruction of the planet. So how does divestment away? I mean, how does that contribute to this new economy? Like, could you give an example of how that is flawed thinking?
Well, okay. So many places to go with that question.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so first of all, about the students and people on campus that you speak of, they absolutely target well-intentioned people. And I mean, so there's no doubt when I'm doing my research and writing these things, this is in no way an attack upon, you know, the people participating in these campaigns. You know, this is what I see as gross manipulation and exploitation of very well-meaning people. It takes divestment, takes the whole emphasis off of who is actually creating this climate crisis. And I can tell you who's creating the climate crisis, something they will never tell you. And it's the 1% of us, meaning you, me, and probably everyone listening to the show, anyone that can afford to get on an airplane. That's this one little handful of people creates half the global greenhouse gas emissions on the planet. So you have a tiny, tiny, tiny handful of people doing almost all the damage, with the rest of the people doing almost, you know, nothing. As far as, and I mean, you will never hear that. Like, this is a huge consumption problem. Where else did I want to go with that question? Basically, right now, what you have, I mean, I try to make it easy. In parts 9 and 10, I believe it is, of my divestment series, I go point form divestment as symbolism, and I go through pointed, you know, bulleted points, what that is, and then I also go through what it's doing. For one thing, this is, to me, probably the most important thing. On one side of the coin, as we are talking about divestment, everyone's divesting, you have private equity firms and hedge funds buying up all the oil. You have Exxon buying back all their shares. I mean, it makes sense. Everyone's trying to grab what's left, right? Even the resource wars, Libya, Syria, all over the world, we're seeing resource wars for what's left. Why? To maintain this Western lifestyle. We have everyone buying up, corporations buying up all the water. And so why would the elites not want to have full control over what's left of all the fossil fuels? The so-called green economy, based on a third industrial revolution, even though scientists have told us we will no longer have any resources even left by 2030, is completely based on further pillaging of the planet. Like, I don't even know where these resources would come, right? Come from.
When I hear about the new economy, I think that the images that come to mind are windmills and solar panels and like electric cars and that sort of thing. And so what?
And I think the point I'm trying to make, but it's just such a broad topic, it's hard for me to pinpoint it in a few sentences.
True.
What I'm trying to say is the so-called clean energy economy is completely based on and dependent upon the fossil fuel economy. So you can never have this, you know, imaginary clean economy of Teslas and windmills and solar panels. I mean, people should stop and look up what goes into one single windmill, let alone at the end of the 20-year life cycle, where it goes. They don't even know. I mean, that's another whole entire industry to be created. So everything becomes about industry. It becomes about how do we, everything, like you started off at the beginning of the show, I think, everything becomes how do we make this into an industry? How do we make money on this? And if we can't make any money on it, we're not going to bother. And, I mean, the divestment, as everyone's talking about divestment, behind closed doors and now being implemented in governments across the world, we have the financialization of nature. And you won't see, and, I mean, maybe someone will find something that I haven't been able to find, but I cannot find one NGO campaigning against what's happening right now, and that is payments on ecosystem services. The financialization of nature, putting a monetary value on everything that's left on this planet, a virgin, untapped market of the size and lights that no one's even seen.
So when you talk about ecosystem services, you mean things like rainforests that are absorbing carbon or?
Everything. We're talking about every single thing that provides a service. Blade of grass, sunshine, I'm talking ants, I'm talking worms, I'm talking every single thing that you can go outside and see. I mean, this is happening now. All you have to do, Google payments for ecosystem services, and up will come millions, I don't know, hundreds of thousands, millions of hits. The United Nations Global Goals is all about the implementation of the financialization of nature. I mean, so the whole divestment thing is such a huge distraction. I mean, it does nothing to stop the exploitation, the plunder, the pillaging of the planet. And in fact, it furthers it. It further accelerates it. I mean, I can't believe at this point in time when we should be saying, okay, we really need to scale back, you know, and reduce. What can we live without here? Like, what can we live without? But instead, now we're going to redo the entire face of the planet, you know, with you know, quote-unquote clean, green energy infrastructure that will just further plunder and exploit. Like, look at mining. You know, look at mining. Like, and, you know, it's an inconvenient truth that we just pretend it's clean and green when you can look at lithium mining. If you Google lithium mining, you'll see stuff that blows your mind that looks like the tar sands out west. Google, what is it, the effects of acid in mining, and you'll see red rivers, tailing ponds. I mean, the list just goes on and on. It's all plundering. But it's framed in such a way that it makes us feel good about our consumption. And like you said before, alleviates the guilt.
Yeah, it's like there's gold in them, their nature. You know, it's all about making money and using this whole process of financialization. I was wondering if you could address this, this topic of the... This entity called Ceres, C-E-R-E-S?
Right. Ceres is American. It's a group I had never even heard of until a few years ago. One of my peers, John Stauber, who wrote the book Toxic Sludge is Good for You, he said, you know, someone needs to write about this group. You know, it's important. Can you do it? And I didn't really want to, but like everything, you look into it, and yeah, it really, really is important. And so basically, they work with, you know, the Fortune 500 corporations. They're a partner from inception of the divestment campaign. And yeah, they're just behind the whole thing. And now they've just, like, 350 is now an international organization. Ceres has branched off and opened up Asian units. I don't know, I think about 7 different organizations across the planet, and it's all about, you know, sustain, quote-unquote, sustainable capitalism, basically just a huge greenwashing project for corporations. It's just, again, make people feel like we can do this in a sustained manner, and there's just no way to do this in a sustained manner. This industrialized civilization is not sustainable and never will be.
I understand that it was originally an anagram of the Coalition for Environmentally Responsible Economies, and it came on the heels of the Exxon Valdez disaster of '89.
Yeah.
When it seemed like after the Bhopal incident in '84 and then the Valdez, it looked like these extractive, resource intensive industries were kind of on the ropes, and so this came out as a response, and as you put it, greenwashing, a way of continuing business as usual, but looking basically kind of avoiding what could have been a conceivably a serious rebellion that would affect the bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, this goes back, like you said, long, long, long time ago, 86 or 87, when that whole concept came up. I forget the woman that started it. I mean, but now it's a million-dollar institution, right? I mean, they charge membership fees, and the top 500 corporations, the Fortune 500 corporations, I mean, and basically all the big players on the planet paying huge fees, and Sirius comes in behind them and does all the media releases, you know, works with them on media releases, and you know, basically how can we're going to change, and we're going to do this new economy, green economy, and it's just a big greenwash. And all the different, I have them listed in one of the articles, maybe in the one that you're referring to with the Earth Day article. I have listed their principles, and they're all voluntary, right? Like, it's just all more of the same, more of the same, and they're all in bed with the corporations, and they're all dependent on the corporations. And, you know, it's all really one and the same.
In other words, there's no such thing as socially responsible investing.
I mean, no. To invest anything, it has to grow. To grow, we have to plunder, we have to exploit under the system. I mean, if you should have thought long and hard, there might be types of things that you can grow without exploitation of people and planet. But off the top, I can't think of any. Under the system, you would move your market. Like, even if you're moving your money from, say, from Exxon, into where you're going to move it. Well, you want to move it where there's money to be made. So, you know, what does that leave? That leaves a lot of other things that exploit in different ways, like porn. You know, porn is a multi-billion-dollar industry too, but it's not fossil fuels-based per se. It is dependent. I mean, there's so many different things to put your money in. Apple, I mean, all kinds of corporations that are dependent upon mining. Is that sustainable? I mean, they'll have you believe it is. Right now, you can find fair trade mining. Everything's becoming certified because that's another billion-dollar scheme set up and run by NGOs, right? Billions of dollars to be made in certification. I mean, it all makes everybody feel better. And at the end of the day, we're just racing to the cliff.
When you're talking about investment in the economy, there's a lot of money to be made from war and militarism.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I find it strange. I mean, if these climate groups are really earnest, it seems strange that there wouldn't be that alignment between the climate movement and anti-war and anti-imperialist movements. I remember, for example, during the 1980s, when there was a real concern about a nuclear war, there's a quote attributed to the late astronomer Carl Sagan saying that the nuclear arms race is like two men waist deep in gasoline collecting matches. You know, in other words, like militarism we cannot tolerate any more militarism. We got to get rid of it. And as you know, the single biggest institutional producer of greenhouse gas emissions is the U.S. Pentagon, the U.S. military-industrial complex. And I don't see prominent climate activists or hear them making much mention about this imperialist trajectory that we've seen just in the last decade or so.
And I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, Van Jones, who is on the board of 350, he was a cheerleader for, putting a no-fly zone over Syria. I mean, he's a cheerleader for war. It's disgusting. There's no anti-imperialist movement at all. I mean, everyone's cheerleading now over Bernie Sanders, who makes the same promises as we already heard from Obama over in the U.S. And he isn't opposed to all the foreign trade policies that have happened in the past and allowed this to happen and continue. I mean, the Western lifestyle is dependent on these wars, right? And, it's appalling. It's absolutely appalling. And environmentalism today, like when we look, people think we're told by media and that these are leaders. They're not leaders. They're cherry-picked and they're groomed and they're appointed by the establishment. And they're not activists at all, and they will never talk about the military-industrial complex because they know that's not to be spoken of. And they're all in bed with the Democrats in the States, and they're all, the Dems are just as pro-war as anybody. And, it's appalling. I mean, everyone in the so-called left is up to their neck in blood of Libyan people, Syrian people, and just it goes on and on and on all over the world. And that has to be, that should be the very foundation of all movements. And it's just a tragedy. You know, this whole movement is completely, you've got this hum, this flow of racism that just thrives beneath the movement.
Speaking of that, on that topic, one of the articles you wrote was called "The Most Important Cop Briefing That You Never Heard Of," and it refers to the what happened in the, I think it was the COP, the 2009 conference, in which essentially a lot of the African countries and countries in the global south were appealing for a much more ambitious climate target than what these the mainstream and non-governmental organizations were pushing for. Could you address that point?
Yeah. Like we knew way back in 1990, the United Nations actually had a group called the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases. And I came across something that mentioned this paper in my research a few years ago, and this paper was nowhere to be found, so I ended up I'm not sure if I called on the telephone or how I contacted them, but I got in touch with an institute that had this paper, and they actually mailed it to me, and it was huge, and I had it put into two PDF files, and now I have it online for people to read. Anyway, back in 1990, I mean, they stated at that time that 1 degree was going too far, right? And already, obviously, today, people knew that back then, and now today we're quote-unquote demanding two degrees or demanding that we don't go past 2 degrees. Anyway, back at the COP15, I was at that conference, and I probably would never go to another one because now that I see it's completely futile, I wouldn't waste the carbon. But anyway, I'm glad in retrospect that I was at that one because I was able to record the speech given by the representative of the G77. And what happened there right before that COP conference, there was a huge campaign that came about, and people listening to your show may remember it. It was called Tick, Tick, Tick. And it just came out of nowhere, and it wasn't until after the conference when I started doing the research I found out what this was, and it was Tick, Tick, Tick came. It's also called the GCCA, and it's an organization of 20 groups, including Greenpeace, Oxfam, 350.org, and 17 others, and they basically created with the largest advertising agency in the world this tick, tick, tick campaign, and they collected, which is a huge part of the NGOs, the nonprofit industrial complex, is collecting data and email addresses. So anyway, they collected, I don't know, 14 million names before, you know, and by way of a petition before that conference. And you had little islands, you had the nations that were really on the front lines of climate change demanding, you know, real targets. Bolivia was probably at the forefront. They were making real demands, and they were demanding the radical and necessary emission cuts that we really needed. And in this one instance, the representative of the G77 that I filmed, I believe his name was Lumumba Dapkin, you know, he basically referred to them as the CIA, and I mean, it's a video well worth watching. It's up on YouTube. And maybe when you post this online or something, you can direct people over to watch it. It's also, you know, in my article that you referenced earlier. Anyway, the people, it was all NGOs in the room, all, you know, big shots, representatives of these biggest NGOs in the world. And they actually, when he was done, they stood up and applauded him. And then they left the room and basically, again, demanded 2 degrees, while those on the front lines demanded we don't exceed 1 degree, like the UN had stated back in 1990. You know, so it's just, again, showing millions and millions and millions of dollars spent protecting the system, protecting those at the top, you know, manipulating the populace, pretending we have budgets left that do not exist. Yeah, anyway, it's, like I said, it's appalling. It's absolutely disgusting, and it's appalling. And that's why I write about it, because even if I can't change it, I'm going to document it.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting when you talk about that that advisory group report from 1990. I mean, like you say, it's not something you could just – well, I guess you could now, because you say you've turned it into PDF arguments, but when you – we're trying to find it, it wasn't as simple as doing a Google search. I mean, you really had to work hard to get that information.
Yeah, it's buried. I mean, you can even find a Found a Friends of the Earth paper that referenced that paper. You know, like those organizations at that time had that data. And then they go on, flash forward, 15, 25 years to demand a full doubling of that. And why? So we can further grow the economy. I mean, it's all about growth. It's all about growth. You know, if I could sum up the show in one sentence, I would say it's all about growth, economic growth, not growth of knowledge, not growth of respect for our earth, not growth of respect for each other. It's all about economic growth that benefits the handful at the top.
And growth is it's a sacred cow in our modern Western industrial civilization, but it's also, I think it was Edward Abbey who said that infinite growth on a finite planet is the ideology of the cancer cell.
It is. I mean, look where we're at today, and we're still going down the same road, right? I mean, it's amazing, you know, but at this point in time, I think, you know, we grew up in this culture, and I think decades and decades of indoctrination. It's just so difficult for people to even imagine anything else. Mm. You know, now we're raising a new generation of children who are so connected with their screens and their phones and everything else. I mean, it can only get worse as the more we get, disconnected from nature. I mean, now we're going to assign a monetary value on everything, you know, down to the last ant and earthworm. So everything outside is not to be respected. It's just another thing that that's bought and paid for, you know, another thing owned by the corporations.
So I guess we're just about at the end of our time, but I wanted to give you a chance to close. I'm kind of concerned about where things sit now, because we've seen so much, there's a lot of energy to make a difference, but you know, it seems like most of the people we have been traditionally looking to as leaders are leading us back to filling the profits of Wall Street and other investors. How do we resolve this in our own minds? I mean, how can we? Is there any hope? And if not, what can keep us going in a positive way?
God, that's a good question. It's very, very difficult. I mean, the more you approach the truth, the more you wish to speak to the truth and acknowledge your reality, the more you're isolated and marginalized. So that is in itself difficult. I mean, we're at the point of no return as far as climate change goes. All we could hope for now is to make, you know, to slow it down as much as possible. It's really, really hard. I mean, we're all enslaved in the system, right? I mean, it's a system that keeps us enslaved. It's really, really hard, if not impossible, to break out of the system. And so it works in more ways than one to keep us, part and parcel. So, you know, I think people should try as much as they can to starve the system. I think they should try as much as they can to work outside the system. But I think it's, you know, unfortunately it's sort of like a monster that was let out of the cage, and it's just so huge and big now that we can't possibly get it back in. That being said, maybe it's not the worst thing. I mean, humans, just like all the other thousands of species that we've driven into extinction, will become extinct too, and maybe that's not the worst thing. I mean, obviously we've shown that we can't live in harmony, at least in the West. We certainly can't seem to live in harmony with the Earth, so, you know, maybe that's the way I look at it. It's not really a bad thing. Something's got to give, and, you know, the sad part is, we always think of things in human value, and if we had been different, if we could think different today, if we could put Earth and other, you know, nature, all these other things ahead of human need by direct, you know, we would directly impact ourselves. We would be better off for that. But we don't. It's always human need. And if anything else, you know, gets any good out of it, well, it's a win-win. But really, who cares? We want what we want at the expense of everything. And I don't know. I think we need just to pursue knowledge and step back and start critically thinking. And it's never too late for that. I mean, that's important, right? We need to teach our children empathy, teach them why they don't need all this shit that clutters their minds and clutters their lives. And sometimes I think maybe that's just the best we can do. Be our best and become more aware, think critically, and become more knowledgeable.
Corey Morningstar, I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. I found it very valuable and probably one of the best guests I could have had on Earth Day.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I hope I can come back again.
Well, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. We've been joined by Corey Morningstar, independent investigative journalist, writer, and environmental activist, and you can find more of her work at the website theartofannihilation.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.